Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
This is Autoline After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 250 for July 18th, 2014. Lawyers, luxury, and life after sedans.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
All right. Good evening, everyone who's watching and everyone who will be listening tomorrow and watching tomorrow and so on. Some of you may recall that I have not been here for the last few weeks, and lo and behold, John's not here. So there isn't some sort of falling out that John and I have had that we won't be appearing with one another. John happens to be right now out on a Dodge program where he's driving the 707 horsepower Dodge Challenger, which I did earlier this week. Now, I would say that John and I would talk about that car next week when we'll both be here, except for the fact that John will not be here next week. So instead, we're going to be having the annual Autoline draft. So we want to let you see some little information about this draft from our longtime color commentators, Mark Phelan of the Free Press and Scott Burgess of Motor Trend Magazine. So here we go. Just watch this.
I'm Detroit Free Press auto critic Mark Phelan.
I'm Scott Burgess, the Detroit editor of Motor Trend. And we're here in sunny Arizona to talk about the automotive, Autoline.
Not
fantasy.
Really Arizona, come on.
It's a fantasy draft. And we're going to have some of the best automotive journalists in the country making the choices, deciding who would run their car company, where would they want to be based, all of these things, right?
Who is the politician that you would want on your board of directors?
If you had to hire somebody to run your car company who is not an automotive executive, who would you choose?
What movie would you want to have your company affiliated with?
All that and more on the Autoline Automotive Fantasy Draft, which happens
July 24th,
on a computer near you.
Fantasy.
Okay, so the fantasy's over. Now this is back to reality and some semblance thereof. So this is a great night because I think that we have one of the best panels we've had in a very long time, and we're also going to do something special. So among our panelists, Keith Naughton from Bloomberg.
Hey, Gary.
Glad to see you here. We've got a first-timer, Bill Visnick, who's with Edmunds.com. He's a senior editor at Edmunds,
and
he's the guy who knows more about powertrain than anybody that I know, even those guys that we've had on the show who don't do engines for a living. Bill knows more than they do. And last but certainly not least, we have Michael Robinette, who is the managing director of Automotive Advisory Services at IHS Automotive, and Michael knows more about supply chain and process and all of those things than anybody I know. And so here's the kicker. This is the special thing we're trying tonight. We've got producer Chip Drake, who is normally behind the camera, who will be in front of the camera. So here's the deal. So ordinarily, you're sending in questions, and John or I are looking at these questions and sometimes asking them and sometimes not asking them. Well, Chip is going to be asking the questions during the run of the show. So send them in. And so if we happen to be talking about something like, oh, Mary Barra in front of Congress today, and you have something you'd like to know about that, send it in. And we've got Chip there, and Chip will alert us, and we'll try to integrate.
I'll interrupt you just like I'm doing now.
He'll interrupt me, and trust me, he's shameless about that. He has no problem with that. So speaking of Mary Barra, and since you're the Bloomberg business guy, Keith, what's your take on what happened today when she appeared? And I think this is worth saying. The name of the it was the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation Subcommittee on Consumer Protection, Product Safety, and Insurance. And the name of today's session was examining accountability in corporate culture in the wake of the GM recalls.
Yeah, brevity is not their strong
suit. Oh, my God. I mean, this is unbelievable.
Well, she was on the defensive again, Gary, as she's been in the previous two rounds on Capitol Hill. But this time, the difference is she's on the defensive for her chief lawyer, Mike Milken, who was completely under attack. Claire McCaskill, in particular, Senator McCaskill, was calling for his head. And she was saying, no, 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 we have fired other lawyers, but not the top one, because this is a man of integrity, and I want to keep working with him.
Yeah, that sort of surprised me that one of the things that that Mr. Milken was emphasizing was his long tenure at General Motors, that he'd been there for quite a long time. And wouldn't that sort of be the thing that you don't want to talk about?
Well, I mean, if you really look at it, the people who are now running General Motors are the people who've been there for a long time.
There is that.
You know, Mary Barra has been there for, what, 35 years?
Mm-hmm.
Mark Royce, I mean, on and on.
Right.
So we don't really have a new crew running GM. We have an old crew, and actually they've brought back some of the old crew, and Tony Cervone, their head PR person. So it's kind of like they brought the old band back together to try and resolve this crisis, and she doesn't want to lose what she considers a key member of that band. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if there will be any more personnel changes. I think she feels like she's done with the 15 that she fired. I'm not sure that's really satisfied the critics or Congress.
Well, yeah, I mean, many of the senators seem to be incredulous that there aren't more people who have lost their jobs. And I think that today they didn't really break any new ground that after the House testimony when the Veloukis report came out, where the attorney did the analysis of what went on and you know, the high levels of incompetence that seemed to have been rife during many years at General
right.
Motors came out.
Well, the latest wrinkle is this New York Times report from a couple of days ago that showed that internally GM knew that its faulty ignition switch may have been the cause of some accidents in Texas, in particular, one where a woman ended up pleading guilty to involuntary manslaughter, I believe it was, because she had a little bit of Xanax in her system. And it turns out the GM lawyers, according to these documents the Times got, realized that the problem was that the ignition switch failed mm-hmm. and the car turned off and the airbags turned off. And that's why this woman's passenger died. And they didn't come forward with this information. So now it goes beyond ignorance to concealment.
And it was also interesting that we saw the head of Delphi for the first time testifying.
Right, Rodney O'Neill. So, yes, and we've kind of been waiting to hear from them, but really, you know, what they have to say is we did what our client asked us
right,
to do.
Right, and I thought it was interesting, and I got to give Mary Barra a lot of credit, that she said, we're the OEM, we're the systems integrator, it's
right.
on us.
Right.
And it's not on the supplier. And I thought that was...
Yeah. I don't think she took any additional hits today.
No, I think that was great
love. But I think we still have to see how the legal team story plays out. I think mm-hmm. that there's still more shoes to drop there.
Well, I think it was significant that she did at least say, you know, the buck stops here,
right?
You know, I think, you know, typically when there's kudos to be handed out because, oh, they've got some great new feature or... You know, there's something, some development that really was a supplier development. Typically, the supplier has to take the
right.
back seat on that,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
So let's not put them out front now that there's a little bit of trouble. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, so I think that was doing the right thing. You know, ultimately, whether there's what that means about culpability in all this, that shouldn't make any difference, really. I think if you're a lawyer, let's say, you know, well, you know, we were working together on this. Okay, you were working together on it. I don't care who you say is responsible or not. We'll figure that out, right?
Right.
The thing that's hanging over all of this that's most significant is the criminal investigation that the Justice Department has going.
Right.
Will someone be charged criminally in this case? And, you know, obviously that's still an open question since they're still investigating. It could take some time. Their criminal investigation of Toyota took 4 years. So, but will somebody go to jail is the question.
Right. So are we done now seeing General Motors people being dragged in front of Congress?
No, I'm not going to say that.
Do you imagine we're going to have...
There's nothing else scheduled that I'm aware of. But,
right. Yeah. I think they're doing cruise liners is the next on the docket. I'm quite serious about that. I'm not making that up. And for those who have been on cruise liners who've had one of those horrible diseases that we always read about, that, you know, they probably need help. All right, so let's move on to a perhaps brighter GM story. And that of Johan Denayschan being named the president of Cadillac. Now, so for those of you who don't know who Johan Denayschan is, and, you know, I know you guys know who he is, but some of our audience may not know, he was previously the president of Infiniti Motor Company. He joined Infiniti on July 1st, 2012, so needless to say, he hasn't been there that long. Before that, he was with Audi. And he was the president of Audi of America from December 2004 until he joined Infiniti. And before that, he was with Audi as president of Audi Japan from April 1999 to December 2004. And from 1993 to 99, he was the general manager of Audi South Africa. And he is from South Africa. So, what do you guys make of Denayschan? He's, you know, Audi has become a great success in the United States. It wasn't a great success in the United States. I think a lot of credit can be given to Denayschan for this. Is this going to help Cadillac?
Michael.
I think there's no doubt that Audi grew immensely, both in image and in volume, number of dealers, basically across the board while he was in charge. And actually, you could also argue that he had quite an impact on Infiniti, even for the short 2 years that he was there. Certainly there was a lot of product that was already in the pipeline, so he can't take full credit for that. But I'm sure he had his hand on a lot of the content, the imaging. He rebranded, rebadged almost all the vehicles. Knowing that he wanted to move more closer to what Audi was doing before. And so certainly, I'm sure the hope is that some of that's going to rub off on Cadillac. And arguably, they got much, much better product at Cadillac from which to work from. The cupboard is definitely not bare. In fact, it's fairly full, and there's some more coming. But it's now a little bit more of an image and changing the ideology of what consumers think of what Cadillac.
But what I want to know is what happened to Cadillac this year? They had such a hot hand last year, and the ATS was going great guns, and all of a sudden there's this big stall this year. They still have good products. What happened?
I think part of it is the CTS pricing. The pricing got advanced quite a bit on CTS, and they're holding their guns on pricing. They just don't want to incentivize the vehicles. They're probably being very smart about fleet and daily rental and that lack thereof. And I mean, there's a lot of different contributing factors, and actually, you know, a lot of really good luxury branding or luxury new products on the luxury side. CLA is an incremental product, just came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mercedes never had a product like that. Now they do, and that goes right up against ATS. Right. So there's a lot of interesting dynamics in that luxury space.
But don't forget, we had ATS, and then CTS stepped on ATS, and so you...
Right, but CTS is priced so high that you'd think it wouldn't step on it as much. So,
But it's justified. It's quite a good product. It's a very good product. Mm. But again, I think the image is going to have to continue to catch up.
There's a big gap, really, I think, right now in Cadillac's lineup. They don't have much in crossovers, really. The SRX is old in the market. Still not entirely the right package, I think, in some ways. And so, as we've seen, and I think we may talk about this a little bit later, too, but crossovers are where you have to be now. And I think, it's great to have wonderful sedans. And I agree, the CTS is a fantastic car. In many ways justifies really that move up in price that did happen. A lot of technology there, a lot of heavy product development in that car, but it's still a car. And, you know, they need more action in crossovers, frankly.
Well, you know, the thing about Denayschan, though, I mean, I would dispute your position on him with... Yes, shock.
Oh, my
shock.
Gosh. I didn't know this was going to be controversial. Just,
well, it ought to be. I mean, I don't want to keep going, but I mean, okay, so here's the thing. Okay, if we look, so he was running Infiniti Global, okay, and admittedly, he was there for a short period of time.
Right.
But I don't think that the needle has been moved at all in terms of Infiniti up against BMW, Mercedes, Lexus, I don't see that. I think
there's a couple of decent, like Q50.
No, I mean, I'm not saying there's not decent cars, but that okay. But so I don't think that it's perceptually
from a market standpoint
in the same realm.
You know that they've done anything.
And I know my viewers depend on me having some statistics, which I sometimes roll out with.
Oh no.
And so this is just U.S. sales through June. So Infiniti division total cars and trucks, and curiously enough, they actually sold more cars than trucks. So
maybe they have a deficit.
That's all. So
they're doing all right. But okay, so Infiniti division total through June year to date is 59,341 vehicles, and Cadillac is 82,117 vehicles. So Cadillac handily outselling Infiniti.
I'm saying that.
Cadillac's got something, but the thing of it is that they sort of, as you point out, have been floundering in the market. Is this now going to provide some direction? And the other thing that I sort of wonder about is that, you know, they moved Denishin from Auburn Hills to Hong Kong because Infiniti is going to be this big global thing, and Cadillac is always talking about being, you know, the standard of the world and being a global company. Do you think this will make them global?
I think they have sort of the right building blocks. They certainly have a hot hand. Bill's right. They need a small crossover that would go against the next three. I think Infiniti might still outsell Lincoln.
Well, that's just cruel. That's just mean and cruel.
I think the truth is that Infiniti's...
I think you might outsell them, just, you know.
Infiniti's image remains muddy, I think, at best, really, in this market, you know, and probably globally, too, for that matter. I don't know that Denishin was there long enough to, like you say, have really much of a strategic impact, at least anyway. I would agree with you on the one hand that his decision to go to alphanumeric nomenclatures for all these and change up all the names was not well received. I mean, even some of Nissan and Infiniti's own people have sort of said, well, we really kind of wish that hadn't happened, but... Mm-hmm. So that's the one thing we see sort of visibly on the outside that happened. But I don't know that he was there long enough that we can make any judgments necessarily about he did or didn't.
After hours.
It's not long enough to have an impact, I think, of any significance.
You know, Gary, you mentioned about Cadillac going global, and I've long contended you cannot go global without a good C car. And now they have a good C car with ATS. So they actually have something that they can use to go global. But if they just had a CTS going global, don't even think about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Europeans, they own that segment. So they've got a good C car. They've got a strong basis from which to work from. But it takes time. It's luxury.
Mm-hmm. Where they need to go global first is China. Yeah. And they've tried that. And it hasn't
and that's
worked,
what Lincoln's
and they're
doing.
Trying it again.
Lincoln, got, you know, they're going. They're going to use China as a volume play and continue to come back. So.
Okay. So with that, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Infiniti, and we're going to talk about Acura. So, Ben?
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability, impressive mileage, Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle, these old stallions are ready to run again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Product, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
All right, so my producer told me that I made an error. That I was supposed to say Bridgestone Firestone, so I just want to make it clear that that's what you just saw, Bridgestone Firestone, for those of you who are not paying close attention. So, okay, we were talking about Infiniti, and Bill, I think you said that their image is sort of muddy. And so earlier this week, Acura put its new TLX sedan into production in Marysville, Ohio, which I give them great credit for building their luxury product in Ohio and not bringing it from somewhere else in the world. I think that's a good thing. But, you know, I sort of wonder, you know, we were talking about sport utilities, and they've got the MDX and the RDX, both which sell tremendously well. But then when you look at their cars, not so good. And it's been quite a long time since they've really had a hit on their hands in terms of any sedans or anything for that matter. I mean, I suppose we can all wait for the NSX, but... So Where are they in this whole mixture? I mean, you know, so we automatically default to the Mercedes and BMW and Lexus, and then what? I mean,
well, you know, I think where we sometimes get off track a little bit, and by we I mean just sort of how we talk about it in a large sense. There's luxury, there's BMW, there's Cadillac, there's Mercedes, and I think there's near luxury, right? And I think that's really this sort of twilight zone that Acura's in now, where they're luxury cars in many respects, and you know, they have all the features and all the trappings and all that, but they're not really quite luxury. And so, there's not a flagship there, let's say, you know, a $100,000 flagship. There's not a high-dollar sports car. There's nothing really that insinuates to the customer, at least anyway, this is a big boy luxury car, in other words, you know, and I think that's probably one of the problems. And I think, frankly, as one of the first luxury brands, a lot of people did understand where they came from, which was sort of nicer Hondas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in some respects, Acura, I think, suffers from that now because that is maybe an image problem, right?
I think, full disclosure, I'm an Acura owner, and actually I'm on my second generation. But I truly think that their last very good car that really hit the market and did well was the 99 TL.
That vehicle,
they made them in droves. They had a great mm-hmm. job with that car.
What year was that again?
99. Okay, it was a while. And I have an 07 MDX, which I truly love as well. But I will agree with you. I think the content of a lot of the mass market players has moved up
Absolutely.
Tremendously. You look at an Impala, I mean, you can just put everything you right. want on that vehicle. And from a content perspective, so where does that leave some of these more traditional near luxury players? Where do they play? And I think that they're getting squeezed. You got Mercedes with a CLA. So Mercedes is moving down. And so you get this squeeze play is very difficult for the Japanese luxury players. Mm-hmm. That's one of the big problems that's going on right now.
Mm-hmm. I agree with Bill. I think still part of the sell for an Acura is, you know, this is really a Honda. So, you know, does Audi say, you know, this is really a Volkswagen?
You know,
they try not to, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So until they get to the point where they stand on their own 2 feet and they seem to think the NSX return, having a six-figure sports car to sell, mm-hmm. will somehow ignite that, I'm not convinced.
I give them kudos that there's enough differentiation with the TSX, you know, with all-wheel steering, and there's a couple things you can get on that vehicle that you just can't get on anything else. So hopefully that's going to, I don't know if it's going to drive a lot of extra volume, but hopefully it'll drive some margin for them. And, you know, let's face it, the economy scale for that vehicle is driven off the fact that they make Accords in the same plant.
Right.
And as long as that equation still works for them, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Chip.
Gary, if I can interrupt, there's actually a good chat going on in the chat room about this, and Bill seemed to have sparked mirror dart because he says, I hate the phrase near luxury. In fact, I think later on he says that should be banished. But he does, somebody else said, Googly says, if you sit in a Rolls Royce or a Bentley, now that's luxury. Caddy, BMW, Lexuses are not full luxury. That's just their additions to your conversation. However, I do want to tell you, we do have a phone call regarding the GM hearing, so I don't know when you want to take
it. Oh, let's take it now.
Okay, well, Ben.
Hey, Gary, great show. Jonathan out of Ben, Jersey. Not a question, just a comment. Yeah, this nonsense with the Congress scowling over GM executives for inefficiencies and effectiveness is ridiculous. Our government is the worst. Makes General Motors look like a godsend. And didn't the government own General Motors for a while, a couple of years ago? They should say just as guilty. What are we talking about? 13 people who passed away because their car turned off? This is nonsense. This is just the government showing big business why they have to, in the future, pay lobbyists a lot of money to offer to the congressmen and the senators so that we favorably view business. Anyway, it's my two cents.
Okay.
I don't give a shit anyway.
All right, thank you. Appreciate your call.
Can I make one quick point on GM? The one thing that should not be forgotten is, despite all of this controversy, they have gained almost 2 points of market share since before this began. It was 16.9 at the end of January. It was 18.8 at the end of June.
And so,
in the United States.
Now, do you think maybe this is a case of product trumping bad news, or is this basically a lagging indicator in that the proverbial chickens will come home to roost?
And there is data and there are anecdotes showing that people who are coming in with their very old Ions and Cobalts to have the recall repair done are going into the showroom and buying new GM cars. Because they're shocked at what they see.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot different than the car they bought 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So far, there is no weakness showing up in GM's U.S. sales, despite, you know, carpet bombing headlines for the last, you know, five, six
months.
Do
you think car buyers are essentially immune to recall type news anymore?
You know, it's become front page news in this because it's a record recall year. It's huge. It's like the home run derby.
Right.
You know, we have so many recalls this year. It'll be the biggest year in history.
It hasn't affected sales much.
And it hasn't affected sales, and it hasn't affected General Motors.
Right. And just to the point of the near luxury, which seems to
pseudo luxury.
I actually wrote I hate to quote myself, but what the heck. So I wrote a piece this week about the Hyundai Genesis, which
near luxury.
Well, Hyundai likes to put it up against all of these, you know, marks, and my attitude, you know, is like, okay, there ought to be this category which is called the serious substantial sedan, okay? and that's the new category, and so this includes the Impala you were talking about, you know, so you can get an Impala loaded up and it costs you 40 grand, or you can get a Taurus and load it up and it's going to cost you 40 grand, or you can get a 300C and load it up and it's going to, you know what I mean? And so you have this whole suite of cars that, you know, aren't really luxury, but that doesn't really matter unless you're somebody who is concerned about having the, you know, Rondel or the TriStar or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you were talking earlier, Michael, about this whole notion of, you know, as we go forward, what becomes the real differentiator in terms of what car makers are bringing to market? I mean, how do they distinguish themselves, whether they're luxury car makers or even, you know, mainstream car makers?
I think you know, I'm not going to speak for everybody. I think we'd all agree that, you know, quality is kind of, you know, it's more perceived quality. What's my service experience? What's my sales experience? How's my vehicle treating me over a longer period of time? It's not, oh gosh, the radio doesn't work and I got to bring it back. It just doesn't happen as much as it used to. And quality, if you aren't good in quality, you're not in the market. So tomorrow's differentiators are image, brand, and who can get the content into the vehicle quickest. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we continue to tell OEMs, don't forget your suppliers. They're the ones that are giving you 70 and 80% of your content. And if you're nice to them, maybe they'll give it to you for a couple of years, and you can get in front of everybody else and be that next fourth door or whatever new content is going to draw customers to that vehicle. Mm-hmm. That's the new differentiator.
Right, and it sort of goes back to what you were saying, Bill, that in many cases, OEMs come out with these new products with these new features, and the suppliers invented them, or the suppliers, you know, came up with the idea, and they really get no love.
In a way, the OEMs are more or less the branders of this technology now, and, you know, for right or wrong, you know, sometimes they don't do it very well, but, you know, they become the face of it, in essence, you know, and so suddenly, you know, somebody's got this new innovation for, you know, infotainment control or something like that. Well, chances are that was some supplier's thing, you know, but this car maker has decided they're going to be the ones to, you know, sort of break the ground with it. And, I think you're right. I think a lot of this stuff, the differentiators are between near luxury maybe and luxury, are going to be more the tertiary stuff and not the product itself necessarily. Right. You remember when we used to look at panel gaps, right? You know, just, you know, interior pieces and how they fit. Now, you know, if you look at that on an Impala, it's fantastic. I mean, you know, it's at a level that not that long ago you would have expected to see in a BMW or a Mercedes or something. Now that has all become one conglomerated.
It doesn't matter anymore.
No.
Now it's actually more the package. How does this vehicle work together to keep me happy and to get me to where I want to go?
And it's me more of the world.
I'm sorry?
To connect me to the world.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
The technology.
Yeah.
You know?
And I guess if we want to go one step further, I think one of the future, you know, differentiators may be how well you begin to adopt and integrate autonomous technology,
right. Mm-hmm.
as that becomes more a part of the playing game now, really. Mercedes already has a self-steering function on the S-Class, right? That may, in some cases, be the real reason to buy a luxury car, I guess, you know, maybe in the next 5 years or whatever.
The real reason is to not drive, let it drive itself.
Right. And that seems oxymoronic in a way, but I think that will be one of the big next technology sets that starts to make the difference between maybe an Acura,
yeah,
where you can't get that price point out of that car, you know, in a Mercedes or a BMW, where, okay, we can bring this in.
All right, I got to give it out to Acura, though. You can buy the RLX, and it does have the adaptive.
It does, indeed. You're right.
Steering.
You're right.
And so it does have the cameras and lane keeping assist. Now, it isn't as fully featured as the Mercedes
right,
system,
right.
So I don't know which supplier provided it to Mercedes. I think it's coming out, but that's another story.
Right.
But, Chip, you had something for us here?
Yeah, before we leave Cadillac in the dust too far, I don't know if the panel can help Scott in Cleveland with this, but he says that we haven't heard or read anything about the Cadillac Omega platform car in a long time. Anybody have anything on that?
So meaning the big giant Cadillac, the one that was...
You drew in air there, Mike, so go ahead.
It's coming.
Yeah?
It's coming.
And will it come in our lifetime?
It's coming. I know that, I remember, God love him, Bob Lutz, talking about...
The 16,
and still one of the nicest concept cars I've ever seen, but still just a concept car. But, there's one coming. It's coming.
Was the El Mirage concept, was that also presumably on that?
I think that is a good lead-in to sort of design-wise where they want to take that type of vehicle.
Yeah.
I think we all know it won't be a coupe. It'll
right,
be a four-door.
Right.
But that's where they want to take that vehicle.
Okay, so this sort of brings us back to what we were talking about, that to have credibility as being a luxury maker, as you were suggesting, Bill, that you have to have some big... imposing, impressive car.
Heavy artillery there, right.
And
right.
So whether this would be, you know, the 8 Series or the S-Class or the A8 or the LS460, I don't even know what the Infiniti
one
is.
Well, it seems like a natural for Cadillac, though, because they were for so long defined by big.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the big Cadillac was the Cadillac. And they kind of lack that now. Since I don't know the death of the Fleetwood, so
that's a good point.
They need point. To. That was their space, and they've ceded it for years now. And if they re-entered that space, you could hopefully resurrect that imagery.
But so does that become just sort of an image car? You know, you were saying, Michael, about how the differentiator going forward is going to be branding and
right.
positioning and image. I mean, is that what a big car would do for Cadillac?
Well, it would be their new, in some respects, their technology testbed to try out a lot of the new technologies and have it bleed down. But if you think about it, you were talking about the Fleetwood. Actually, their last big car was a DTS, front drive.
Mm-hmm.
They probably said internally, there's no way we're going to build a large front drive vehicle any longer.
Right.
We're going to wait for rear drive. Well, that's what's coming. And rear drive is the basis. And if you want to make it all-wheel drive, perfect. But let's start with rear drive because that's what all the big players, that's what all our competition
S-class,
has.
Everybody. Yep.
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 Mm-hmm.
Well, that was the centerpiece of Cadillac's transformation 15 years ago when, you know, they had an almost entirely front drive lineup, really. And they said, listen, if we really want to be taken seriously on the world stage, and this gets back to the attempt to get back into, you know, global as a global player way back when, they said, we can't do this with front-wheel drive platforms. No one takes that seriously.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, so we're saying that they need to have this big car, but we said earlier they need to have a compact SUV mm-hmm. crossover vehicle. So are these things at odds? I mean, is the bandwidth sufficient that you can come out with some giant Fleetwood, let's just call it for the sake of argument, and a compact SUV?
One is for volume and the other is for image. And the volume helps you fund the image car.
I would argue you must do that. Not can you do that, but you must
you
do
have
that
to.
Now.
So we saw Lincoln, which you clearly enjoy, they made the decision to go with the MKC,
yep.
The compact crossover.
It's a lovely car.
Mm-hmm. Rather than going with their big whatever, which they say is coming in 2 or 3 years, I believe.
Right.
Two.
Yeah, that'll be the last of their big new products.
Right.
Yep. They need to start small, I think, is the message there. This was their first, C car. And instead of doing a car, they did an SUV. I think that was a smart play because that's where the growth is. And at this point in the compact, smaller than SRX category,
right.
There aren't that many players. There are some very small, strong players, but there aren't that many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they don't have to fend off quite as much competition.
Well, but
and it's growing quickly. There's
right.
a lot of players coming.
Right. So one of the reasons I was gone 2 weeks ago, whenever I was gone, I was driving the new Lexus NX, which is their compact, and that's a category that the luxury SUVs are. Small one with the RX, obviously, arguably they invented that category. And so they've come out with their small one. And then, as you mentioned, I think it was you've got the BMW has the X3, mm-hmm. Audi has the Q5, yep. Growing. And which is since we're talking about this subject, a natural segue to, so IHS came out with some numbers this week showing that SUVs and CUVs have outsold sedans for the first time ever. Why don't you?
As a body style, you see the trend not only here, but more and more in China. China has always long been known as a sedan market. It's a couple of hatchbacks, but a lot of sedans. But SUVs or crossover utility body styles are really catching on there. But certainly a lot of the growth, you look at all the segment fillers, as we call them, or white space fillers, they're all BCUVs, CCUVs here. We just got finished talking about the luxury segment. There's some new cars coming, but, cars have been here, sedans and such have been here for a long time. It's really turning out to be more of a crossover world. And the Europeans are finally picking up on it. And that's one of the core markets that could really take off.
Isn't it amazing? Because didn't you remember when Paris wanted to outlaw the SUV?
It's because PSA wasn't building them. Yeah. They actually had to get them from Mitsubishi.
So now they're buying them. So, it's just come full circle.
The world comes full circle.
Well, as we all know, this is a very cyclical business, right? And you can remember when we were having this same discussion about trucks and cars, right? Yeah. When traditional trucks, and SUVs, and it was the same thing when they eventually overtook cars as a the majority of sales in this country. And, I think we're repeating that again. It's sort of funny because if you look in just about every segment of the market, whether it's just mainstream cars or mainstream segments or premium segments, the utility vehicle really is the kind of the hotter choice right now, right? Mm-hmm. A sedan's almost seems so limiting now mm-hmm. or something, and a wonderful car is a 5 Series, right? And it used to be sort of a benchmark for the real heart of the luxury market now. And I think a 5 Series is kind of a tough sell to a lot of people now, because they're, what am I going to do with that?
Mm-hmm. I just think it's amazing. I think you guys have identified an inflection point. I mean, after decades of sedans being the body style, we all knew that SUVs replaced station wagons and probably minivans for many people. But now they're replacing sedans, which had been the standard for so long. And it's amazing, given that this is a body style. I know that we call them CUVs now, too, but consumers call them SUVs. And it's a body style that was given up for dead in 2008 when gas prices shot up. And here it is, the leader.
Well, there's a couple of enablers. They're all coming off the same global platforms of those same sedans, so you don't change the engine box. You're using the same engine, a lot of times same drivetrain, so that's number one. So from an economies of scale perspective, we don't care whether we build a crossover or a sedan as long mm-hmm. as we build something off that platform. I think the other one is we're all getting older, myself included, and we don't want to crawl into a sedan as much as we used to. We want to open the door and kind of slide into the vehicle. It's just a lot easier. So people are just saying, from a practicality perspective, I'd rather just make my life a little easier. Right.
But, you know, it's interesting. You know, I think you put your finger on something by calling it an inflection point, because looking at these numbers that IHS Polk came out with, so it goes back to 2009. So for sedans, it was 36.3. Then the next year, it's 36.2, 36.5, 36.5, 36.6. And up through May is when the numbers were. Right. So for sedans, it's 35.4. And then you look at the numbers for SUVs and CUVs, they combine them. And they're bumping along 31, 33, 34, 33, 33. And now, boom, 36.5. So, I mean, a full point ahead of 1.1% over sedans. And so, I mean, it's just like it's happened.
It has happened.
We got to remember that right now the movement into global platforms, and I know some of the listeners know what that is, doesn't know, but basically structures that are global, that they're built in China, built in Europe, built here. The movement in North America is really hitting a stride right about now. And they're not only bringing sedans off them, but as we mentioned, they're bringing a lot of crossovers off them. And that's really an enabler. Before, we used to be pigeonholed in North America. We only have our crossovers, and they're only off of our platforms that we just build here. But those days are finished.
So does a car maker make more money off of selling a SUV than a sedan, than the comparable sedan that is the platform?
I'm not necessarily sure about that, but I will say this. They could be more competitive when they build a crossover off of a platform that also has a sedan off it, not only because of economies of scale, but if they want to afford something like forward adaptive cruise. Well, not only do they have the sedan they could put it on, they can also put it on the crossover because it uses the same electrical system. So now you can actually up-content these vehicles more easily than you used to. Mm-hmm. And I think that adds to the bottom line.
Okay. So before we take another break, you guys want to add anything to this?
Well, I think if you look at transaction prices, and I don't have the exact figures on that, but I would say that typically, you know, if you want to compare apples to oranges and sort of, you know, a mid-series, midline sedan versus like a midline crossover, I think transaction prices for the crossover are higher than a sedan. You know, you just people see more sheet metal there, you know,
right.
And I think they're willing to pay for that. And the one other thing I wanted to throw in about that, you know, the rise of crossovers, I think, too, has been, you know, the perception before was, well, if I get a vehicle like that, I'm not going to get good fuel economy, right? And now when you knock them off of these global platforms, the powertrains are the same. So the only thing you're really giving up is, you know, maybe a little bit because of the weight. But we've seen the fuel economy for these vehicles really sort of increase, you know, rather quickly in the last several years with the rollout of a lot of the new powertrain technology. So now the customer doesn't even perceive it as necessarily, well, I'm going to, you know, really have to pour some gas in that thing, if I want to buy it. Now they look at it and say, I can do that, you know.
I'll be interested to see when the industry and we in the media change our mindset, because right now we think the horse race is car. We all know the Toyota Camry is the best-selling car, and the best-selling SUV is, let me think, I don't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
When do we start thinking about it as an SUV-driven market, not a car-driven market?
When there's over 300,000 of them sold.
Well, I mean, you know, they have more market share, right,
brand
than they do cars.
One
you know, that's where the
one of the issues now is that the market's been splintered. You know, you used to have maybe two or three sport utilities in a brand, and now you've got many, many more.
Right.
So are we going to see another day where we sell, you know, almost 500,000 Tauruses? You know, that was, what, 15 years ago or something? Mm-hmm. That's going to be a lot tougher because of the way that we brand a lot of these vehicles now.
Right.
But,
right.
I mean, Chrysler is one of the hottest companies right now, and they don't really have a competitive family car. But what they have is a really hot SUV franchise.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's what drives the industry.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly what the IHS numbers are showing.
Yeah. Right.
Even though if you look at the highest volume sellers, you know, any given month or year or whatever, they're still cars for the most part. You know, as far as actual volume play goes, at least anyway. You know, Camry, Accord,
and then
Civic.
And of course, Ford with F-Series.
That's on the other side.
All right, so we're going to have Chip, then we're going to take the break, I think.
Yeah, because Beauregard Jackson has a question that I think goes to right what you guys are talking about. He's asking, small CUVs and SUVs, the whole panel, who's doing it the best? In other words, the smaller sport utilities versus the crossovers, who's doing it the best? I think he wants to know, Beauregard, do you want to know which manufacturer is doing it the best, or is it, or are small CUVs versus, I mean, CUVs versus smaller SUVs?
I'll ask you guys. Okay, it seems to me that when we're talking about CUVs, SUVs, that's sort of old nomenclature.
It is old.
That they're basically all...
I think people call them SUVs.
Yeah, I mean, they call them SUVs. They know what the crossover is, and we made the distinction that SUVs was body on frame.
That's right. I insist on that one. I do.
That an SUV is a body on frame.
I will not call it an SUV unless it's on a truck platform.
Right. Okay.
No.
So basically, we're down to like a handful of those, and
right.
And those
and everything else
like
is on a car platform.
Tahoe and the Expedition.
Right.
And
now the Japanese still have a few banging around out there.
The Land Cruiser
and the
QX, whatever it is.
Yeah,
there's four or five of them out there.
Right, but everything else, the vast number, whether it's an Explorer,
unibody,
or an Escape,
Mercedes,
GM,
or
the big GM,
right. So then they're all crossovers. So who's doing the best whatevers?
My vote would be. In the mainstream, Ford and Honda are doing the best. They're certainly the volume leaders with Escape and CR-V.
Right.
Ford has a good, midsize and Explorer, which is also car-based now. They, to me, are the clear leaders in capitalizing on that market. In the luxury space, I would give it to Audi.
I would say that the Europeans have done a really nice job with smaller crossover utilities. They've kind of invented a lot of those areas. But if I look at sort of a midsize crossover, and I hate to almost call it this because they don't like to hear it, but I still think Grand Cherokee is still the class of the bunch. I really do.
Bill?
Yeah, I'd have to sort of sit on the fence on that one a little. I think you're right. The Grand Cherokee is just a phenomenal success in just any way you want to look at it, and well into its age in the market now, it still looks very fresh, and people are lining up in droves to buy it. You cannot argue with the success of that. I think from an overall snapshot of the market, though, I think you're right. Ford, a lot of volume there, right? Same with Honda. They sell the hell out of the CR-V. They sell the hell out of the Pilot. It's hard to argue with how they've worked that formula into real volume. And Toyota probably, too, for that matter.
Yeah. They RAV4.
Sell a lot of them. The new Highlander is a very, very good vehicle. Yeah. So they're doing a good job.
Well, and if you dig into the IHS Polk numbers, you see that the new Cherokee is a lot of what's driving the growth.
That's just been
such a runaway hit.
Right.
And they arguably were not in the market for a good period of time.
Right.
All
right, we've got to take a break. We've got to hear from Hyundai. So, Ben, give it to Hyundai.
Nice. Not nice.
The new Elantra from Hyundai. Nice.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go.
And we're back. Okay, so for some of you who were watching before the show officially started, you might have heard these two guys talking about something that was going on, some news that broke today. So why don't you guys tell the rest of our audience about what you heard about the potential takeover of one car company by another?
Go ahead, Keith.
Well, it's a manager magazine out of Germany, which is a legitimate, news source that's broke a lot of big stories in the past, saying that VW is interested in Fiat Chrysler. And denials all around, of course. That's the way these things always begin. But it is tantalizing. It would certainly fill a lot of holes for Volkswagen, starting with a North American presence, a legitimate North American presence, but go beyond that and look at the product lines. I'm sure VW would love to have a real, legitimate, full-size pickup truck like the Ram. They would love to have that minivan. Imagine putting that in China as a luxury car. They could probably get $150,000 for an Audi-badged town and country minivan. Mm-hmm. You know, and the Jeep franchise that we were talking about a minute ago, oh my goodness. And how ironic would that be that Volkswagen, a company that was at least spiritually supported by Adolf Hitler, would come to own the Jeep?
So, Bill, what do you give at odds of this happening?
I'm still thinking about what he just said.
Nobody wants to touch that. It's true.
No.
You want to see Ferdinand Piëch and Hitler together over the Beetle, the people's car? There's
first,
a picture.
I think it may be a long day before we see that, but I just think the idea is insane, frankly. I don't see what really. Okay, first, never mind the dollars that potentially would be involved in such a take, if it did turn into a takeover type of a situation. But the very things that you just mentioned, Keith, you know, wow, how attractive Ram would be and what a wonderful thing it would be to have Jeep. That's the same thing that Daimler was saying when they took over Chrysler years ago. And we saw how much equity get destroyed in that particular. And in the meantime, Chrysler, it got Chrysler nowhere. Got them a couple of decent platforms, right, that they're still using
Grand Cherokee now,
including the Grand Cherokee we just talked about. But really, that was, you know, for the very same things that appeared to be advantages then, they weren't able to capitalize on it. Volkswagen's got its hands full being Volkswagen, I think, right now, you know, let alone bring in all this. I think the idea is insane. Then you have all the other things around the edges, Ferrari and, all the other brands there, that there would be conflict.
But wasn't the story, though, that Ferrari would be basically the company that would remain, and there would be concentration on Ferrari, and forget all this mass market stuff, that the owners are not that interested in selling, you know, run-of-the-mill Fiat cars, that they really are interested in
Ferraris. They're certainly interested in selling run-of-the-mill Chrysler cars.
And Jeeps.
And Dodges.
Yeah.
But in terms of if there was this takeover, right, that it would be Ferrari would stand alone and the rest of them would go. What do you think? You think it's going to happen?
I don't know if it's going to happen, but it is interesting. Let's take a look at what Fiat FCA really is. And you know, Jeep is very, very valuable. Yeah, I mean, and even through the bankruptcy, you know, you had OEMs around the world licking their chops thinking, boy, if I can get my hands on Jeep, that would be a great franchise to have. And they've done a great job, you know, expanding in China, different places. Obviously, you have some issues in Asia, and that's where Volkswagen is very strong. So OEMs around the world, they look at other OEMs to say, would I fit well with this OEM? Does this fit well? And everybody does it. So the fact that this is at least being contemplated doesn't surprise me. Is it going to happen? I'm not so sure. But it doesn't surprise me. OEMs around the world, they're always looking at each other saying, hey, you'd be a nice fit.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Piëch, the new Piëch, the current Piëch, has stated that he wants Volkswagen to be the number one car company in the world, right? How does he get there? Mm-hmm. What's his market share in the United States?
So he's going to buy his way, too?
Well, what's his market share in the United States?
See, but
he wants that on a very accelerated basis.
That's got to be a painful thing to look at every day. And
they're on their eighth plant in China, eighth or ninth plant.
Right.
They are building cars like nobody's business in China right now.
But they also announced this week that they're going to be expanding their plant in Chattanooga.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
they're going to be building the new what? Crossover SUV.
Smart play.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but see, but
they want to double sales here.
But see, I'm surprised that they went for the 7-passenger one rather than what were we talking about earlier? Oh, compact ones, right? So
the compact is a huge hole in their lineup right now, too. They need to get to that as well.
But they're going
to
build it off a platform that they can build a small one if they want to.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they've got the flexibility, and they'll have that in there. And I think while you're saying it's a 7-passenger, and I don't disagree with you, I think you got to think a little bit more Santa Fe, where it's going to be a little bit more of a tweener type vehicle, almost like Journey size a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so it'll work well as a 5, and if you want to, it'll squeeze in 7. Mm-hmm.
There we go. There it's up right now, but. You know, as I looked at that and I saw them announce that this week, at the same time, I had to think to myself a little bit, You know, I hope they move that styling along a little bit by the time it gets here in 2016, because that already is looking a little stale, frankly. So,
sort of reminds me in that picture, in a way, of an Explorer, and you mentioned earlier.
It has Explorer cues. I think it even has pilot cues.
Yeah, so. I would agree with you.
So it's a double win then, right? Because
those two vehicles were designed 5, 6, 7 years ago.
No, they're the successful ones we were talking about just a few minutes ago. Okay, we got another one from Chip.
Well, actually, before you guys started talking about the Cross Blue, Daryl and Dean wrote in and said who wanted to know what VW hopes for the Cross Blue's penetration in the U.S. market, and he wanted to know the production figures, but I don't think
anybody knows any of that.
What are their hopes for penetration?
Well, let's talk about the plan.
Better
first.
Than a Passat.
Well, let's put it this way. Anytime you're going to spend $900 million on a plant, that's what we call a mama-sized plant. That's at least 150, probably pushing 250 when you start to push overtime. So, but by the way, that's not the only vehicle that they would build there. At some point, they'll feather right. in some other vehicles as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that they're looking to do, I can't remember the numbers, but I'm sure they're looking to do at least $100,000. Right. Now, they'll want to export that vehicle as well. Remember, you know, we're not just building for the U.S., Canada, Mexico anymore. We're starting to export mm-hmm. more and more vehicles.
Right.
Okay. Well, my understanding is that plant that they intend to put the Cross Blue out of is, in effect, a mirror of the plant that's there now. So you just flop it over on the other side. That plant is, I think, capacity is about 150,000 yeah. right now. So, they're not going to make 150,000 of those Cross Blues. So at some point or another, right. there is going to be an other product, I think, that you see.
Oh. And they've probably got some.
Inevitable.
They've probably got some spare capacity on the other side.
And the Passat side, too, yeah. right now. Yes. Yeah, as far as that.
Right. I think at some point they're going to fix that. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So in the last closing minutes, Chip, we're going to try something where we're going to throw out some questions from the audience. You guys have to be really fast. No right. long, just like that. All right? Go.
Isn't Ford collaborating with BlackBerry on an in-vehicle connectivity?
Yes.
Yes, they are. That's going to be the new platform.
And that's the big talk, is that's the move, the drastic move away from sync and all its problems now.
Microsoft, yeah.
And isn't it funny, after the IBM Apple announcement, that BlackBerry's fortunes took even a deeper slide? But it's another story.
Reports on the internet talk about upcoming Colorado will spawn a Raptor competitor.
I'm not sure you can shoehorn a V8 into that box. So it'd have to be a V6 based. Maybe they blow a V6 but I'm not so sure about that.
Maybe they can source an EcoBoost from Ford.
Or find a way
well,
to
you're just poking the
or find a way to fit up some horsey diesel or something in that something pumped up even from the diesel that they're planning for production. The Raptors has a lot of people intrigued and has for a long time, but in effect it's pretty low volume, kind of a play. So right. How much money do you want to spend developing?
Should Ford do a Boss 429 Mustang? Seems like it's the only version they haven't.
Well, curiously enough, Bill and Keith were both at Ford today, and they were both with the Mustang, right?
Yes.
So?
Well, we got a chance to ride in the Mustang right. today. We didn't get to drive it. We got to ride in it, though. Yeah, 435 horsepower from the V8, the standard V8 GT Mustang. I don't know if they need a Boss 429.
It felt pretty Boss.
It felt very Boss.
And the independent rear suspension, that thing now in curves, oh, my gosh.
Really working. It's really working well.
I wonder what a real suspension in the rear would do for you.
It's amazing.
So I don't know that a Boss 429, but then again, Chrysler doesn't need, nobody needs a 707 horsepower Challenger either, right?
Oh, Gary? Come on. Everyone does.
I think the sky's
more power.
I don't know. Maybe this is the last era of the really heavy-duty, big artillery muscle cars. I don't know. Maybe there will be a Boss 429.
Will Alan Mulally help Google find an automaker to use its autonomous technology?
I think that's a big reason that they brought him aboard. I think they definitely want some insights into how to crack the car market. And in Alan Mulally, they got a great expert and a great engineer. Who understands, obviously, the aerospace business as well. And I think Google wants to play there, too.
I thought it was quite interesting that he joined Google's board and the fact that they've made no bones about it in terms of their play in automotive. So I thought it was quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think Alan is their entree, and I call him Alan because I know him so personally. But
I thought you were going to like start snoozing when we talked about that.
Well, you know, no, I think there is a little bit of a fascination with Alan Mulally still, I think, right now.
A little?
In this town, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I sometimes I'd like to just let executives go on their way once they leave, you know, but I think they see Mulally as definitely entree to understanding the car business better than they do right now, which is probably not all that deep of an understanding.
See, I think there's one interesting thing that I haven't seen anybody bring up is the fact that what was the job that he was in running for that he didn't get?
Microsoft, eh?
That's right. He's in charge of Microsoft.
Poke the finger in the eye of Microsoft.
Exactly.
I'm going to Google
that. That's number one. And then number two is sort of to your point, I think that the people at Google are probably getting their doors beaten down by OEMs who want that technology. So they don't need Mulally to give them an entree. I think that maybe they need Mulally to sort of be like the guy with the velvet rope, deciding who gets in and who doesn't get in.
Razors and razor blades. That's interesting. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and maybe entree is not the right word, but maybe somebody who has insight into, you know, what works in this industry, you know, and how you really, you know, sort of move things through this business, which is very different than the way you move things through the tech business.
One of our Twitter followers is asking if the Mazda Diesel 6 is being scrapped for the U.S. market. He's hearing that from a Mazda sales manager.
Bill?
Well, you know, I don't know. Scrapped is a very final sounding sort of term. You know, I think it's unquestionable Mazda has backed off of what it talked about with diesel, you know, just a couple of years ago. There were plans there, you know, and they seemed fairly definitive about it, and now they're not so definitive.
Mm-hmm. You know, their gasoline, their new Skyactiv gasoline engines, they're very, very good engines.
Very good.
So, you know, if you can't justify, you know, 10, 15, 20,000 units, then don't bring it in because mm-hmm. it's too much cost to add to all the dealers
right.
and have them stock parts.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other, you know, I think one of the problems right now and the reason why you see the OE sort of still hesitant about diesel is because there's so much uncertainty in the fuel price in this country. Yeah. And you know, there's no stability there. And you know, gasoline prices bump around some,
right.
too. But diesel is just really wild. And when the price gets up to where it erases the advantage of having the engine to begin with,
right.
that's a tough sell to some sure to a is. Customer.
All right. Final question.
With all the talk of autonomous driving, what's the future of truck drivers? Are self-driving trucks the wave of the future?
Unless we have self-driving forklifts taking the stuff off, I think truck drivers are okay for a while.
Yeah. I mean, conceptually, it makes a whole lot of sense
right.
that would be
right,
the thing.
It does.
On the one hand, because you know a lot of these guys are you know driving between nowhere and nowhere else. But on the other hand, you think about how much those things weigh. I mean, and what problems could arrive.
I think self-driving UPS trucks make a lot more sense. Wherever the concentration of population is, mm-hmm. is where you're going to need self-driving cars. I'm not sure you need a self-driving truck down the middle of North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
You need it in Manhattan. And if we're going to get to this self-driving future, it's going to be in the big cities, and then everything will be self-driving.
Mm-hmm. And then there'll be drones taking the things off UPS trucks. So anyway, all right.
New world, baby.
Okay, new world. All right. So with this new world, see, all you who watched, I told you this was the best panel that's ever been on the show. And
oh, and John's not here.
I can't follow that.
Look how well
all right.
Went
so,
look
wow.
how well it went without.
It'd be the only
right?
time we get invited.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
I'd have you guys back tomorrow, but I won't be here. No. So... Keith Naughton, Bloomberg, thank you very much.
Thanks, Gary.
And you're doing a great job there. Michael Robinette, IHS Automotive.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good seeing you again. Bill?
Thank you.
Edmunds.com, good seeing you.
Thank you.
Let's see. So you can find these guys everywhere and me on AutoFuelGuide.com. Friend Autoline at Facebook.com/AutolineNetwork. Follow Autoline on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. And so, okay, remember we had that thing at the beginning of the show about the draft. So next Thursday night is going to be the automotive draft. And so you're going to have Scott Burgess and Mark Feeling making smart-ass comments about things that I say, Jeff Sabatini from Car and Driver says, Paul Eisenstein of the Detroit Bureau says, and Aaron Bragman of Cars.com says. So they're going to be making fun of us, and we're going to make fun of them, I think. And it'll be a whole lot of good fun. So anyway, that'll be next Thursday night, 6 p.m. Log in. I guess you can't say tune in. That would not be appropriate. Anyway, so thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Mike.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.